the headlines. A senior member of the Taliban has said that the group seeks good relations with Afghanistan's neighboring countries, including Iran, under an Islamic emirate. The row over Turkey's decision to reopen an abandoned Cypriot resort town deepens as Cyprus joins other European countries to condemn the move. And American officials say that overall life expectancy in the U.S. fell by a year and a half in 2020, the largest since World War II, amid the coronavirus pandemic. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us. A senior member of the Taliban has said that the group seeks good relations with Afghanistan's neighboring countries, including Iran, under an Islamic emirate. Khekhwa said the Taliban is strengthening ties with Iran, quote, day by day to solve problems, since this approach serves the interests of both nations. He noted that the Taliban and neighbors of Afghanistan need each other in every way. He said, therefore, regional governments should join hands and cooperate with each other. Pointing to Taliban's deal reached with the U.S. last year, Khekhwa reiterated that all foreign troops must leave the country. Khekhwa said that there was no secret agreement with the U.S. about the pullout of foreign soldiers. He said the U.S.-led forces failed to establish security in the country 20 years after the invasion of the country. The deal was made during the term of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Foreign forces have now largely left Afghanistan, and the remaining ones will go home by September 11. The Taliban have launched a nationwide offensive and have taken control of many regions. The full interview with Khekhwa will be broadcast over the next few days. Tehran has unveiled a documentary film called Life Among War Flags, which narrates different aspects of conflicts between armed groups, including Taliban militants. As Saman Khujuri reports, the film has revealed a big secret called Taliban, and clearly responds to questions which have for long been formed in the minds of international audience regarding the militant group.
The Iranian documentary film Life Among War Flags, which focuses on Afghanistan and the Taliban, directed by Mohsen Islamzadeh, has been unveiled in Tehran in the presence of the filmmakers. The documentary movie Life Among War Flags narrates a different story of conflicts between armed groups in Afghanistan. Moreover, it has made research on the role of the Afghan government in such conflicts.
I have been making documentaries for about 17 years now. The Life Among War Flags depicts the story of people whose region is controlled sometimes by the Taliban, sometimes by Daesh, and sometimes by a central Afghan government and the U.S. forces. I believe they are the main victims of the war in Afghanistan. Making this documentary film was very difficult because we had to risk our lives when we went among Taliban forces. We even took part in several Taliban operations to make this documentary film.
One of the special features about this documentary is that they have shown the inner side of the Taliban, which is very dangerous and difficult. Making such a documentary will definitely raise public awareness about the real nature of such groups, which is of course so risky for the filmmakers.
The production of this documentary took 19 months to complete. The documentary's director says it has unveiled a big secret called Taliban and clearly has responded to questions which have for long been formed in the minds of international audiences regarding the nature of the militant group.
The documentary film Life Among War Flags takes a deeper look at the lives of Afghan people who have tolerated years of war and bloodshed under different names and have learned to show flexibility to survive. Saman Khujuri, Tehran.
A prominent media advocacy group has urged Israel to halt exports of its surveillance technology following revelations that Pegasus spyware was used to target journalists. Reporters Without Borders says that Tel Aviv must stop selling espionage technology until a protective regulatory framework is reached. It added that enabling governments to install spyware to monitor journalists amounts to a major democratic problem. A consortium of 17 media outlets revealed that Israeli company NSO sold its Pegasus spyware to dozens of countries. Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates are some of those receiving the spyware despite being accused of human rights violations. The spyware was reportedly used to target journalists and activists, as well as prominent heads of state, including the presidents of France and Iraq and the King of Morocco. Cyprus has criticized Turkey's decision to reopen the abandoned Cypriot resort town of Varosha, saying that it is, quote, clear violation of UN Security Council resolutions. Foreign Minister of Cyprus, Nikos Christodoulidis, says that the move will have a negative impact on efforts to resume talks between Nicosia and Ankara. On Tuesday, Turkish Cypriot authorities said that a part of Varosha would come under civilian control for potential resettlement. The announcement followed a visit by the Turkish president to Varosha, which is also known as the Ghost Town. The French Foreign Ministry has promised to raise the issue at the UN, calling it a provocation. The EU has also condemned Ankara's move as a breach of international law, criticism that Turkey has dismissed. Varosha has been a sticking point between Greek Cypriot and the self-declared Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. Our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes says Turkey's move to partially reopen the controversial town of Varosha will only heighten tensions between the EU and Turkey.
There's been tensions here since 1974 because, of course, you know, Cyprus has been divided since then. Turkey went into the northern part of the country to try and push back against a Greek-backed coup, and it says it did so legitimately under international agreements. It was just protecting its interests. But the UN Security Council describes northern Cyprus, or the northern part of Cyprus, as an occupied area, even though, you know, Cyprus, the southern part, is controlled by the Republic of Cyprus, which has been a member of the European Union since 2004. Turkey's President Erdogan has been talking about a two-state solution to all of this, but last week, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, she completely rejected that and said that is an unacceptable solution. But Erdogan insists it could be the way forward.
A senior EU official has rejected a UK demand to renegotiate post-Brexit trading arrangements for Northern Ireland. The official said the European Commission will not renegotiate the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol, which requires checks on goods crossing over from mainland Britain. However, the official said that the EU will seek creative solutions to difficulties caused by Brexit and the trade between Britain and Northern Ireland. That after Northern Ireland Secretary Brandon Lewis told the British Parliament that the country cannot go on the clause included in the Brexit deal. He said the application of the protocol had entailed considerable and continuing burdens. The protocol was painstakingly negotiated to avoid a hard border with Ireland by effectively keeping Northern Ireland in the EU's single market. American public health officials say that overall life expectancy in the U.S. fell by a year and a half in the year 2020, the largest annual decline since World War II. The officials have blamed the drop mainly on the COVID-19 pandemic. They say the life expectancy for both Black and Hispanic Americans was even worse, witnessing a decrease of 3 years. Experts have pointed to a range of problems affecting the two communities. These include lack of access to quality health care, more crowded living conditions, and a greater share of the population in low-paying jobs that required them to keep working at the peak of the pandemic. U.S. provocations against China continue relentlessly. In the latest, Washington has accused Beijing of hacking the Microsoft Exchange email system. The U.S. is making the accusation as it has ramped up its hacking and cyber allegations against Russia. Now, the question is whether the U.S. is making such accusations with a political motive while making China appear like the bad guy on the world stage.
Tensions between the United States and China are rising once again. China has roundedly rejected the groundless and irresponsible hacking allegations made by the United States and its allies. Beijing says the allegations are fabricated out of nothing. The Chinese Foreign Ministry has hit back at Washington, calling the US the world champion of cyber attacks. Washington and several allies in Europe and Asia publicly accused Beijing of hacking the Microsoft Exchange server software in March.
Well, I would give the benefit of the doubt to China, given the fact that the United States is on a roll to build up all kinds of accusations against China, really to create an enemy image and to increase pressure on China with regard to many different political and economic issues.
Microsoft Exchange is an email platform used by corporations around the world. senior U.S. officials claimed that hackers tied to China's Ministry of State Security carried out the hacking. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said that Washington and its allies hold China accountable for what they have described as Beijing's pattern of irresponsible and destabilizing behavior in cyberspace. They claim China's alleged hacking poses a major threat to the U.S. economy and national security. The United Kingdom and European Union have also joined the U.S. in accusing China of carrying out hacking attacks. They claim the alleged cyber attacks have targeted an estimated hundreds of thousands of mostly small businesses and organizations. The U.S. Justice Department says four Chinese nationals have been charged in a global hacking campaign aimed at dozens of companies, universities, and government agencies in the United States and abroad.
The problem is that the underlying dynamic here is increasing tensions between the U.S. and China, not because of China's actions, but because of U.S. actions, which often provoke a reaction. A reaction may be increased cyber attacks, but that the basic problem is that the United States is regarding China as a rival, possibly as an enemy, and that's creating a lot of conflict.
The accusation leveled against China by the U.S. is that Chinese hackers stole trade secrets and technology. The U.S. also alleges that China is sponsoring hackers outside of the Chinese government. Meanwhile, the U.S. itself stands accused of conducting the most hacking operations out of any country in the world. China has said that the CIA has hacked the country's aerospace research facilities, China's oil industry, internet companies, and government agencies over a span of 11 years.
China and the U.S. are already at loggerheads over several issues. Last year, Washington took a harsh stance against Chinese tech giant Huawei, effectively banning the company from the U.S. Huawei is currently the world's largest telecoms equipment provider. Over the past few years, Washington stepped up arms sales to Taiwan, which is considered a red line by Beijing. Back in April, China warned the U.S. not to play with fire over Taiwan, as Washington moved to establish more diplomatic contact with officials in the self-ruled island. Tensions in the South China Sea risk turning into a full-blown confrontation between the two superpowers. The U.S. has already deployed 24 F-22 fighters to the Western Pacific as part of a military exercise in the Pacific Ocean. The deployment has been interpreted as a warning signal to China at a time when relations between Washington and Beijing have reached rock bottom over Taiwan and the disputed South China Sea. The exercise is in support of the 2018 National Defense Strategy, which called on the U.S. military to be a more lethal, adaptive, and resilient force to counter long-term strategic competition, primarily from China and Russia.
Well, they are going after both China and Russia. They consider them the autocratic countries in the world. They want this association of so-called democracy, that is the Western world, controlling the rules of the road, and China and Russia have other views as to how the world should operate.
The South China Sea has also emerged as a flashpoint. The United States frequently sends warships to challenge China's claims over the disputed waters under the pretext of safeguarding the freedom of navigation. China is also on course to overtake the U.S. and become the biggest economic powerhouse in the world within the next decade.
The World Health Organization says the Delta variant of COVID-19 is expected to become the dominant strain within months. During a weekly epidemiological update, the UN Health Agency also said that the variant has now been recorded in 124 territories and accounts for more than three-quarters of sequenced specimens in major countries. The WHO also predicted that the cumulative number of COVID cases reported globally could exceed 200 million in the next 3 weeks. The Delta strain, which first emerged in India, is more transmissible than British, African, and Brazilian variants. Coronavirus pandemic has so far infected more than 192 million people and killed over 4 million worldwide. The German health minister has warned that the number of COVID infections might rise exponentially in September if they grow at their current pace. Jens Spahn says the number of infections per 100,000 people over the 7 days could reach more than 400 in September. The current number of infections per 100,000 people is only 11. The country has seen a spike in daily cases since early July due to the spread of the more infectious Delta variant after more than 2 months of steady decline. The German government has extended COVID-19 quarantine regulations for incoming travelers from higher-risk areas until mid-September. Meanwhile, the French premier says the Delta has turned into a dominant variant in circulating coronavirus in the country.
Ce fameux variant Delta.
This famous Delta variant is there. It is definitely there. It is in the majority, and this is its characteristic. This is different with those that preceded it. This is much more contagious. New infections have increased by 140% in 1 week, and there were 18,000 new cases yesterday. That characterizes the situation.
Jean Castex said tougher measures are essential and new lockdowns cannot be ruled out to stem the fourth wave of infections. This as the country is set to unveil a new plan to fight COVID, with legislation being debated in Parliament. The plan will include requiring a health pass in a wide array of venues from the start of August and making vaccination mandatory for health workers. Under the plan, those wanting to go to events or places with more than 50 people have to prove that they have had a COVID vaccination or tested negative recently. The pandemic delayed Tokyo 2020 Olympics kickoff in Japan amid concerns about a rising number of infections in the city. The world's largest sporting event got underway with a softball game in Fukushima behind closed doors. The Tokyo Olympics, which will formally begin with Friday's opening ceremony, will be held largely without spectators to minimize the health risks. The Japanese capital is already under a state of emergency following a surge in coronavirus cases, 79 of those among people credited for the games. The World Health Organization chief backed the event. However, he said the world is failing to stop the pandemic and criticized G20 economies for their poor efforts in this regard. The WHO chief said out of more than 3.5 billion globally administered vaccine doses, 75% have been in just 10 countries. He said in low-income countries, only 1% of people have received at least one dose, compared with more than half of the people in high-income countries. The coronavirus pandemic has so far killed more than 4 million people around the world. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I
Faisal Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're now up to chapter 3 of part 2, and this chapter is talking about how to deal with non-Muslims. And of course, this is a very, very vast topic. It's never going to be something that we would be able to cover in one or two or a few sessions. But Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli points to some very, very important issues that we need to remember as Muslims. We've spoken about mu'mineen, we've spoken about fasiqeen, and now we were going to talk about those who appear to act as they are Muslims, but in reality, deep inside, they are far from that. You know, you say to someone, I'll be there at this time, you don't even turn up. Or I'll promise I'll give it back to you, you don't give it back. When you give your word, you break it. And how simple is this in today's society, unfortunately? We've already spoken about amana, and when you are entrusted with something, you betray it. There are three things that only a munafiq would ignore. This person would be known for that level of nifaq. There are three things that only a munafiq will know and that would ignore and would not honor. Number one, someone who is an elder in Islam, someone who has preceded us in faith, which means that they wouldn't respect, a munafiq wouldn't care about ذو شيبة في الإسلام. Number two, a reciter of the Qur'an, a memorizer of the Qur'an, someone who represents the Qur'an, munafiq wouldn't care, and a just ruler, a just leader. These are the qualities of a munafiq. Then there's a long hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, also in his advice to Kumail, avoiding a munafiq, avoiding someone who betrays, avoiding someone who is a zalim. You know, Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying, stay away from a munafiq, stay away from an unfaithful, a betraying person, stay away from a zalim, and make sure that you never mingle with them in any way, etc., etc. And then another hadith from Imam Sadiq to his companion Ishaq. Ultimately, if you have to associate yourself or sit in the presence of a munafiq, you know, deal with them only with your lisan, you know, just minimize the damage, if we could say, with your lisan. But your love should only be exclusive to the fellow mu'mineen.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book مفاتیح الحیات, The Keys of Life.
این مفاتیح باید دو جلد باشه. چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه.
This book, مفاتیح, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است. چه فلون دماغ و سواب داره فلون روزون است.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درخت کاری اینجا کم سواب داره دعا هم داره سواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته دارم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری میواد ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
The stage has come now where we speak about how to deal with enemies or how to deal with people who are not in favor of us, not liking us. And this is something, of course, very, very natural. Throughout the process of your life, you're always going to come across with certain people who might be different with you in their ideology, in their opinion, in their conduct, in their behavior. There might be a dispute, there might be certain issues that escalate to such a level where they become hostile towards you. Now, there are different kinds of that level of hostility that a person has towards somebody else, but it's never going to be something good or something positive. And as Muslims, we need to try as much as we can to stay away from any kind of enmity or hatred or creating of any level of discord or sedition or problems with other people. But how do we deal with someone who does turn around and become hostile to us? Now, sometimes someone might be offensive in the sense that they want to attack you verbally, maybe even physically. Sometimes, no, they're just an enemy, and they might even, you know, get to a stage where, you know, it is going to become very, very dangerous for you. In any case, what we can see in Ayatollah Jawadi's chapter here is that there are two types of enemies. One is an enemy who is an individual enemy, an enemy of yourself, and another is an enemy of your religion. Whatever the case may be, we know that there is the main enemy of all of us, and that is Shaytan. And we've mentioned a few times the verse in the Holy Quran where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does refer to the Shaytan as an enemy. Inna shaytana lakum aduun fattakhidhuhu aduwa, in Surah Al-Fatir, ayah number 6. And we understand that the munafiqeen are also a person's enemy. And we also understand that in some cases, a person or a group of people who want to attack the Muslim territory, want to attack Islam, are also classified as enemies. Of course, what we need to do is we set Islam as an example of how we deal with these kind of people. And it should never be the case where we react emotionally. It should never be the case where we, if I could say, take things into our own hand and escalate the problem, allow things to get worse and worse. Because the central focus of what it is that Islam teaches us is we need to have that passive approach towards those who might want to be aggressive towards us. Does this mean that we allow them to tread all over us? Absolutely not.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children's cries.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Inside Israel.
Anti-Semitism has been widely used to slander all those who do not agree with Israel in whatever the case might be. But now, Israeli officials are being accused of anti-Semitism. New videos have been recently released by Israeli officials that actually mocks other Israelis and Jews in ways that can only be explained as anti-Semitic. The term has gained widespread popularity on an international level, mainly due to wide use, or some now say abuse, of the word by Israeli officials themselves to justify pretty much everything they do, from internal policy to external policy. But for Israeli officials, the term doesn't come any more handy than when others are criticizing them. When Israel is criticized, it automatically uses the anti-Semitic card to slander others. But what happens if the table is turned? We've all heard of Israeli officials and the regime in general call anyone that points to their crimes against humanity, war crimes, and their dysfunctional system as anti-Semitic. but activists from the non-for-profit U.S.-based Electronic Intifada online newspaper have found that the Israeli regime in its nature is actually anti-Semitic. According to the Electronic Intifada, Israel's new ambassador to the U.K. stereotyped a Jewish human rights group in anti-Semitic terms in a video she released as part of a campaign for her political party. In a Hebrew YouTube video, Israeli Ambassador Zipi Hotoveli mocked breaking the silence as being motivated by money. The video depicts Jews as greedy. According to Jews Worldwide and, of course, Israel, depictions of Jews as being greedy is a major theme in the history of anti-Semitic stereotypes. Breaking the Silence, by the way, is an Israeli NGO established in 2004 by veterans of the Israel military and aims to shed light on the cruelty of the Israeli occupation in occupied Palestinian territories. The video also targets Israeli human rights groups B'Tselem, calling them extreme left, and accuses them of receiving funding from the European Union and being agents of the EU. The video calls on the extreme right to attack these organizations so that their funding will cease to exist.
Anti-Semitism is basically a system that is designed to suppress all forms of criticism of Israel, Jewish culture, Jewish religion, Jewish politics, or should I say, everything Jewish. Whether there is really hatred toward Jews for being Jews in the world, I actually hardly believe it. I think that a lot of people oppose Israel, and for a good reason, and it should be legitimate. A lot of people oppose some aspect of Jewish culture, aspect of Judaism, definitely aspect of Jewish politics, and all of that should be totally legitimized. As long as we don't hate people for being a people, I think that all criticism should be considered legitimate. I think that it is way more than Israel. The answer is obviously yes, but it's not just Israel. This is something that we see throughout the entire spectrum of Jewish politics, and it's not just Jewish politics. We can see that all over the world, politicians are weaponizing anti-Semitism in order to serve their own interests. We saw it in Britain in the case of Jeremy Corbyn. We saw it in the American election. Both sides accuse the other of anti-Semitism. And it's pretty, meaningless, because really you cannot find a single voice in the political arena, in the arts, in academia, who criticizes Jews for being Jews. Again, people criticize Jews legitimately for politics, for culture, for Israeli politics. You have to remind you that Israel calls itself the Jewish state and claims to represent world Jews. Whether it is true or not is another question.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Guy Blue says, "Well, anti-Israel doesn't necessarily mean anti-Semitic." Anok sarcastically says, "People are calling B'Tselem anti-Semitic. At this point, anyone who criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic, even Israelis." CEO of Corn says, "But it does feel a little strange that it can be considered anti-Semitic to criticize Israel, not Jews, but the Zionist portion of the regime, for genuine humanitarian crimes, or labeling American anti-Semitic fascist Nazis being considered insensitive."
Really
shameful what Israel has done and the supporters of Israel have done in terms of false accusations of anti-Semitism. I say that it's dangerous because anti-Semitism is something that is very real, and it usually occurs in modern times within the context of a rise in Islamophobia, a rise in anti-Black hatred, a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment. So it's usually part of a larger rise of fascism in these modern times. And Israel has used accusations of anti-Semitism in order to protect themselves from criticism for their system of apartheid and their human rights abuses towards Palestinians. This takes place both from the state of Israel and from supporters of Israel, including pro-Israel lobby groups in the U.S. And what it does is it really confuses people as to what anti-Semitism is and as to the real dangers of anti-Semitism. You could say that the use of anti-Semitism has backfired against Jews around the world and against so many people who experience racism and xenophobia by falsely conflating anti-Semitism, a very real danger, with criticism, legitimate criticism of Israel's human rights abuses. We dilute the impact of calling out and combating anti-Semitism. And so defense of Israel by Israel as a state and by pro-Israel groups and individuals continues to create a real danger for Jews around the world and for our allies who we are working together with to secure safety for all people.
ZP Hotavelli is the same person who back in 2019, during the British elections, accused then-Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn of anti-Semitism, calling him troubling and a real danger to Israel. This shows the double standards of Israel's principles and practice of hard-right Jewish ethno-nationalism are now simply the new normal in Israeli politics, according to the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, Anthony Lerman. For Israel and many of its officials, the only definition of anti-Semitism that matters is failure to support Israel. This isn't the first instance of Israeli officials and anti-Semitism. In 2017, Israeli-American multimillionaire and key Israel lobby donor Adam Milstein depicted liberal Jewish billionaire George Soros as an octopus with tentacles spanning the globe, practically identical to Nazi propaganda. In 2015, a regime-funded body representing Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank released a video which depicted a Jewish-European conspiracy to fabricate war crimes against Israel. Many see Israel's actions as part of a growing trend to equate criticism of Israeli regime policies with anti-Semitism. Scholars from all over the world have noted that it is increasingly difficult to have a proper discussion about Zionism or a normal critical debate about Israel. Earlier this year in Germany, a renowned scholar, Achiel Membe, who is currently teaching at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, was accused of racism and anti-Semitism by public figures and institutions because of his support of the BDS movement. BDS, that is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, is a Palestinian-led global movement for the freedom, justice, and equality of Palestinians. His case is just one of many.
Yes, completely legal and ethical. The state of Israel doesn't let to do these critics, but ethically it's completely good to say you are doing something wrong. You have to change this policy, as same as you can say to other states. There, the countries in the world they can make errors, or they can do things that are very bad against humans, against human rights. And you have to, if you are a journalist or a political scientist or a professor, you have to say the truth. So maybe they change their ways of behavior. Yes, they are criticizing everyone that it's not from a right-wing ideology. And this right-wing is similar to fascism and Nazism. They are saying, for example, to liberal Jews or to socialist Jews that they are anti-Semites. The Nazi regime in Germany of Hitler accused the Jews to be or capitalist exploiters or communist propagandists. So the Israel regime now is trying to do the same thing to Jews that they are liberal. They accuse that they are capitalist and they sell by money and greed and all these things. And if they are socialists, they say that they are communists, like it still used to be the Soviet Union. That is the case of a liberal Jew named George Soros. He's an Hungarian from Hungary, a liberal Jew that is criticized to be an anti-Semite because he's a liberal Jew and the Hungary government is a friend with the Zionist state now, and they both are ultra-right wings, and they are really the bad guys, and they are making guilty liberals or socialists.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. King Benjamin says, if you're against funding for Israel, you're anti-Semitic. Kevin says, but of course, it's easier to cry anti-Semitism and try to slur Bet Eslam through guilt by association than address its substantive criticism, because the report's analysis and conclusions are careful, sober, and convincing. Jesse says, yes, it is totally absurd. Israel is an awful apartheid entity. 100% agree about the irony in it all. I always say it's not anti-Semitic to be anti-Israel.
Well, of course, we get into the complexity of the overlap between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Zionism is a term, an ideological term that emerges from the late 1800s. Theodor Herzl began a process where there was a lobbying, an effort to create a Jewish state in the Middle East. That is what Zionism is. And Zionism, of course, there's a range of Zionist interpretations and manifestations of that ideology, going from labor Zionism to revisionist Zionism on the right wing. There are many Jewish people from the beginning of Zionism who were hostile towards Zionism, who thought that it was wrong to associate their religion with a political movement. And there are still many Jews, especially Orthodox Jews and rabbis in Israel, who think it's wrong to use the Jewish religion as a basis for the creation of a Jewish state. So there are secular critics of Zionism as well, Jewish voices for peace in the United States, independent Jewish voices here in Canada. And these are Jewish people who are critical of Zionism and are critical of the treatment by the Israeli government, especially of Palestinian Arabs, and the torture and maltreatment and failure to recognize and indeed the tendency to crush the human rights of Palestinian people. And those Jewish critics very much resent being called anti-Semitic because they're Jewish. But of course, oftentimes the term self-hating Jews comes up, and this group can be condemned as self-hating Jews. So it's complex. Well, it may have been overused, but the power of the Israel lobby is such that there really isn't a lot of debate, say within the United States, say within Canada, say within Great Britain, about how the Israeli state abuses this term anti-Semitism. It's kind of a dangerous ground to even criticize the Jewish state for abusing the term anti-Semitism. So this is a phenomena that sees, although it might be overused, there isn't a lot of tolerance for any real discussion of these issues. I look to my Canadian Parliament and I don't see the possibility of much discussion because all political parties are of a similar mind when it comes to Israel. They identify and support Israel in large measure. So this abuse of the term anti-Semitism, it comes out particularly in the way that the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism is being adopted by many governments, by many municipalities, by many universities, by many labor unions. All kinds of agencies adopt this definition, which basically says that to criticize Israel is to be anti-Semitic, that any criticism of Israel can be interpreted as anti-Semitic. There should be much more debate on this, but the context seems to not be there. Well, anti-Semitism is a very ironic phrase. You could say that Semites don't include Ashkenazi Jews, for instance. I mean, Jewish people are genetically diverse. They have many backgrounds. They're not at the moment Jewish people. It's not a particularly missionary religion, but it has been in the past a missionary religion, and Ashkenazi Jews derived from people who were converts to Judaism. And so ironically, Ashkenazi Jews tend to have an elite role within Israel, an elite role within the Jewish community collectively, and this group of people who are not Semites use their power against people who are Semites, including the Palestinians and other Arabs. So that's a great irony of the term.
It seems that the burden that Israel has imposed on all those who are criticizing it has backfired. Israel seems to use anti-Semitic as a weapon, but that weapon has backfired as it has been overused and exhausted. And now Israel's adversaries, who are Jewish and Israeli, are becoming victims of Israel's anti-Semitic slander. This same slander of other people who do not agree with Israel has exposed Israel for what many believe is anti-Semitic in nature. Ultra-Orthodox Jews accuse the ruling white European Jewish secular class in Israel as stealing their identity and their name. According to ultra-Orthodox Jews, elite European secular Zionist white Jews at the turn of the 19th century absorbed the attitudes of anti-Semites in Europe and looked at the real Jews themselves with the same disgust and loathing that the anti-Semites did.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Short wave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.